Welcome. I'm Ira Bogach. The following presentation describes a two-year journey of how one school leadership faculty at Florida Atlantic University revised its master's and certification program to meet new state mandates. The original presentation was made in front of a live audience at the 2008 UCEA conference held in Orlando. We are re-recording our session for this podcast. Missing from today's performance are Tony Townsend, who's now at the University of Glasgow, and Michelle Akrahosevar, who's on faculty at Washington State. Jim Burnham, our new coordinator, will be playing himself and Tony. Maggie Fernandez, a graduate assistant who videotaped the UCEA session, will be Michelle. Present today are Pat Maslin-Ostrowski, Jim Burnham, Daniel Reyes-Guerra, Bob Shockley, Diane Wright, Maggie Fernandez, and Meredith Montfort. We begin by listening to the voice of the state of Florida as Meredith Montfort reads Rule 6A-5.081, titled Approval of School Leadership Programs.
The legislature and the State Board of Education recognize multiple pathways for demonstrating the standards required to qualify for a professional educator certificate. To ensure capacity and quality of pre-service school leadership programs and the development of in-service school leaders required in Section 1012.986 Florida Statute, this rule sets forth requirements for approval of two levels of school leadership for the purpose of preparing individuals to serve as school leaders who may aspire to the school principalship. Level 2 programs build on Level 1 training and lead to certification in school principal. The bi-level certification and preparation process includes programs offered by post-secondary institutions and public school districts.
The primary objective today is to tell our faculty's story honestly and with good humor. Along with other public and private universities in this large southern state, 2007 to 2008 was a difficult year in terms of revising educational leadership programs for the Department of Education. Reapproval during 2008-09 was also difficult as we moved from planning to implementation for 2009 to 2010. We hope that our presentation will be informative as we reveal the internal dynamics of an Ed Leadership Program faculty wrestling with external mandates as well as our professional responsibilities. There were tensions and contradictions and what we call difficult conversations. We cannot tell all, even if we wanted to. We are talking about real people and real situations, but we have agreed to be transparent and respectful. We hope that what we say and how we say it invites you to examine, share, and question your own experiences of educational leadership program change.
It's clear from the beginning that the educational leadership faculty of Florida Atlantic University was not interested in making cosmetic changes, lipstick on a pig, by aligning new standards to old content and courses, but rather to use the state's top-down actions to fuel an holistic rethinking and restructuring of leadership preparation for school leaders. Nevertheless, transactional changes with minimal cost to institutions remain a tempting choice under particularly difficult circumstances, such as unfunded, externally driven mandates.
On its face, a discussion of single department of educational leadership as holding power seems more a fantasy than a reality. But in fact, the geographical location of Florida Atlantic University, its demographics, its recent successes with passing NCATE, in gaining admissions into the University Council of Educational Administration, UCEA, the publicity from its new pilot internship program in a large urban school district, along with the reputations of individual faculty statewide, nationally, and internationally are all bases of negotiated power. Each of the faculty brings with them a constituency to their work, whether known or unknown, by local school districts or the State Department of Education. Gives the faculty the legitimacy, space, and position to exert different bases of power that ultimately benefit local students and the state. In other words, we came to understand our political position. to successfully compete in the marketplace while building a model leadership preparation program.
Jim, as the newest member of our faculty, what do you think about all this?
Like many of you in the audience, we used the state initiatives to make changes that were both needed and already in progress. Thus, to some degree, the state's imposition was a welcomed event. This process brought the faculty into a meaningful dialogue with all the promises and pitfalls of such a process, but it resulted in an outcome that more professionally and more pragmatically addresses the needs of future school leaders. The process afforded the interaction and consensus building needed to make a faculty more whole and have a better understanding of the role each plays in the overall success of our students, and that is ultimately a reflection on us as an institution of higher learning that is in touch with the realities of professional school leadership.
According to the State Department Rule 6A, we could lose state endorsement and maybe lose accreditation.
Hold on, Daniel. I want to call in our chair, Robert Shockley, someone who intimately knows the workings and the key actors on the state level. Bob, what do you think about what Daniel just said?
Well, essentially, yes, we could lose accreditation, or as the state refers to it, as program approval. But I don't think that's going to happen, and I know that's not the state's intent. The state has its own culture, language, and accountability measures. Just look at our state capital. It's physically located in the north central region of the state. It's not easily accessible, at least from where we live and work. But many of us make the trip north because we want to work with the government to make needed changes in education throughout the state. We work very hard to develop a positive relationship with state officials, even though we are so far away geographically and at times philosophically. Where we come together is that we too want our graduates to be distinguished school leaders and to be ready to take leadership responsibilities immediately upon graduation. Rule 6A, the Reform Act that we're referring to here, can be seen as part of a bigger, more far-reaching goal affecting licensure of professional educators, specifically teachers. It's interesting to follow the pattern between what is happening in school leadership and what has happened to teacher education as all part of a larger puzzle. By identifying the patterns with respect to licensure and accreditation, first in terms of what happened in teacher education and then educational leadership, it is almost predictive of what is coming to educational leadership.
You just heard a state insider's view. What makes our department so very interesting is that we can also hear an outsider's perspective from someone on the school leadership faculty, our former chair, Tony Townsend. Here is what Tony said at UCEA.
Well, I guess the reality is that we all need to understand that things are changing very, very quickly. And over the past few years, for teachers, principals, and departments of educational leadership, we have had to deal with changes coming as a plethora of new responsibilities that come crashing in. You don't have time to adjust to the first change before the second change arrives. In these dynamic situations, we have to adjust to new responsibilities, new laws, new requirements, all at a time of diminishing resources.
We pause because we're professors, and as professors, we ponder, but not too ponderously. We reflect, but not too self-reflexively. In so doing, we try to come up with conceptual frameworks. Meredith, is there a conceptual framework that makes sense of all this?
I think there are at least two conceptual frameworks inside this big change process. We should first look at the institutional change process literature and then to the political power in particular. You know, it's not enough just to resist and say we are going to comply with the state, but rather we tried to bring valid theory and evidence of leadership, not only from our current leadership program, but also from the state's huge list of competencies. As a faculty, we made lists of what we see in the literature, what we already teach in our courses, and perhaps more importantly, what we don't see, either in ourselves, our courses, or in the state. For example, we don't see topics like internationalism, social justice, inclusion, experiential learning, adult learning, second language acquisition, and so on, in the state standards and competencies. Yet these are part of what should be as a leadership conceptual frame. Instead, state officials want our graduates to know how to raise student achievement equitably, and deliver mandated programs and changes in today's curricula and pedagogies. The bottom line question, however, are not addressed in the state standards and competencies. To whom are we as educators accountable? What are the purposes of public education in a democratic society? And if I might steal Michael Apple's primary and ongoing question, whose leadership curriculum is this anyway?
So you can see, though we tried really hard to make sense of all this, it comes down to one question. How do we deal with state-level unfunded mandates and policies on the one hand, and as individual faculty, develop best practices on the other? Those of you who are following this video PowerPoint, my comments now refer to Table 1. You can download this video on the podcast. The underlying tensions reflected in Table 1 leads to one overriding research question. How can an educational leadership faculty work through the dynamic tensions created by external and unfunded mandates and still bring best practices to pre- and in-service administrators? Every educational leadership program faculty answers this question empirically, not just conceptually, for itself and for its constituencies. In terms of mandates, we have the State Department of Education and Rule 6A. We also have to work inside the ideology of a market economy. In addition to both the DOE and the market, our students have to take a new state certification test based on the mastery of 91 discrete managerial tasks. I turn again to our chair, Bob Shockley, to ask, how should we make sense of these competing forces?
In the 1980s, the State Department developed criteria for state certification for educational leadership. It created a dual-level system of certification. Level 1 is what universities do. Level 2 is what school districts do. Candidates for school leadership positions needed to meet the two levels of preparation in order to earn their certification. This is the way it has been structurally for many, many years in the state of Florida. There are problems inherent in this structure, of course, and we as a faculty have been working for years to solve the problem even before the passage of Rule 6A. The problem is how we at universities can better align what the school districts are doing. Too often in the past, there has been a culture of us doing our thing and a culture of school districts doing their thing. And those hurt by this structure were the candidates going through the state system. That's the history. In 2000, all state statutes were sunset, and there was a redrafting of all the work that had been done. The new state law governing educational leadership is named the Cecil Golden Act. In the act, there are state-mandated services for professional development, certification requirements, leadership opportunities, and all of which come with online website support in terms of articles and training materials available for educational leaders, programs, and school districts. The intent is to try to build a structure to bridge what's happening in the university to what's happening to school districts. In 2006, the legislature developed leadership standards focusing on instructional leadership as well as describing 91 discrete skills necessary to successfully lead the improvement of student achievement. These skills are part of the William Cecil Golden School Leadership Development Program, a competency-based, comprehensive, and coordinated statewide professional development system for current and emerging school leaders.
Florida has been accused, rightly or wrongly, of not paying attention to what goes on across the nation or the world. Tony Townsend has some important ideas on what we mean by national and post-national standards. Jim, can you tell us what those are?
What we know is that the U.S. defined a series of standards for leadership. The standards identify specific items along with some big picture items. What we also know is that the word standards is not uniformly used around the world. There are places that talk about leadership capabilities rather than leadership standards. If we look at the differences between standards and capabilities, what we see is that standards are based on something we learned yesterday that we could do today. Standards say nothing about what leadership beliefs will be tomorrow. Standards are rooted in the times of today. Capabilities, however, open the doors to new leadership directions instead of looking at the past for guidance. And so, just the conversation that we hold as a faculty about the differences between standards and capabilities is important. It takes us in new directions. Instead of looking at the past, we look to the future to change the directions of leadership.
But how can we move from standards to capabilities when we have a market economy, market forces, and an ideology that privileges competition over cooperation? Any thoughts on that, Daniel?
Well, when you look at the new rule and standards, it's infused with a market ideology. For example, the CECL Gold materials are accessed online and state approved. While all the materials are required, they are not all made available freely. In many cases, you have to pay for the materials. It's not that the state is giving you anything. Not only are you going to have to buy a program developed by the state or by a private organization approved by the state, but the materials are required for certification. That's a market ideology which is permeating the whole system. On top of this change based on Rule 6A, anybody who wants to now can get a program certified and approved. Not just universities, but also districts can now start their own program. A new organization in association with a school district as partners can offer a program. Now, all of a sudden, everyone is in the market and we're all competing. Who's going to come out with the fastest, cheapest product, just so long as it's approved? This is a major market shift for anyone with access to the educational leadership preparation market.
It might be helpful to hear from a faculty member of the Educational Leadership Department who is not directly affected by all this. Diane Wright is an associate professor of higher education leadership and is the chair of a new higher education initiative exploring the development of standards for higher education programs. Diane, what are your thoughts on this debate?
I have had many discussions with my colleagues in higher education on the topic of standards, while not necessarily using the term standards. We actually do not use the term. As I and my colleagues have studied what has been occurring in K-12 education, at least I won't speak for each and every one of them, have come to the conclusion that accountability is not going away. When we became aware of former college president Levin's attack on educational leadership programs, we were thankful that he did not say anything about higher education leadership. But as we read his scathing remarks, he could have easily included higher education, more so because we don't have formally approved national program standards, or an NCAPE. So we in higher education have taken a different approach. Because accountability is not going away, and as the money gets tighter, dropout rates increase at all levels, as does the cost of education, a group of us in higher education are pushing for the standards and guidelines of the sort along the lines of a self-assessment tool, in an effort to act now rather than have whatever it is imposed upon us later. Also, not to repeat the tensions in K-12 education, we have worked for commitment to quality, or what is known more commonly as quality assurance guidelines and commitments to excellence, instead of so-called standards per se, which imply standardization in the eyes of many.
All of this reminds me of the movie, The Matrix. Remember when Morpheus meets Neo for the first time? He describes how Neo must be feeling, like Alice falling down the rabbit hole. He calls this the Matrix, a world pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. In this world, you become a slave in bondage, a prisoner in your mind. But words alone cannot describe the Matrix. One has to see it for him or herself. Then Morpheus offers Neo a choice. Take the blue pill, and the story ends. You wake up at home, in bed, inside the Matrix, blind to the truth. Take the red pill, and you get to stay in Wonderland and see how deep the rabbit hole goes. Frankly, that is what we as professors of educational leadership can offer, a choice between the truth and nothing more. To be very honest with you, we as faculty did not always know which pill we had swallowed. Our leaders in the department would send us reassuring emails of the journey ahead, but they ended those communications with specific tasks, often labeled homework, not once, not twice, but again and again and again. I'm talking homework, not leadership. We were given graded homework assignments. Some emails told us to fill in the attached template. Some called for us to align course content to the new state and national standards. Some brought us into the matrix to pull the world over our eyes. So even as we had swallowed the red pill, we had to live within templates and matrices. What happened was that we as a faculty exploded and imploded. Fortunately, our leadership was there to guide us through what was termed difficult conversations. Pat, as the facilitator of those sessions titled Difficult Conversations, how would you describe what happened?
Ira, the homework wasn't graded, it was just returned with the message, redo. Kidding aside, Michelle and I worked hard to try to filter out what we were learning from the state, but deadlines kept changing and state expectations were also changing. It was a convoluted process that was stressful. Why? Because it threatened the integrity of our program. This work itself of developing new courses brought great drama and emotion to our meetings. In part, this happened because we are very passionate about what we do, and the state's mandates felt as if our philosophical foundations were being shaken. We had to engage in difficult conversations. What courses and content would stay and what would go? It threatened how we conducted our daily business. It was a clash between our autonomy as university faculty and having to deal with outside forces. So you can see the internal-external conflicts that we felt. Basically, we were in cognitive overload, so the conversations were not smooth and easy. We actually turned to the literature and faculty expertise for how to hold together, to hold on to our interpersonal relations in order to survive and continue to take risks. As a faculty, we prided ourselves on the way we have always treated one another and on our trust and respect for each other. And now, we were struggling with all of this. We will continue to struggle during implementation. We will go back and forth, inside and outside the standards and competencies, to bring democratic leadership and social justice that are outside the standards to our students.
Where do we stand today? Do we stand alone, or are we standing alongside our educational leadership colleagues nationally and internationally? Our last words now come from our department leaders who led us in this change, Pat Maslin-Ostrowski, Bob Shockley, and Michelle Acker-Hosevar, spoken by Maggie Fernandez.
My last words have to do with the conundrum, which is that educational leadership programs are conceived as both the problem and the solution. We are the bad guys not doing it right, but also the ones needed by the state to bring about reform. It is a reform dilemma for us. Do we buy into these external rules which are being imposed for the goal of raising student achievement and test scores? And if you buy into that, you become part of the system and lose your faculty autonomy. So, in making changes, do we develop counterinsurgent strategies to work with the state and also to do what is best for our students and with our district partners?
There were many positives and many negatives that evolved from this process. For this faculty, rather than taking all of the state's competencies and skills and trying to fit them into our existing structure, which is historically the easiest thing to do with a current program, the faculty said, no, let's use this opportunity to completely rework our program. They put everything, every course, on the table. I think that part was a very healthy decision, and the students will be the beneficiary of that process. The other issues of mandates and skills are ongoing. We are still not where we need to go. We are not where we want to be yet. We need to embed what we think are our leadership principles into the process. We're not there yet, but it has certainly been an interesting journey.
For me as professors, it is our responsibility to bring new knowledge and skills to the field, whether or not the government mandates it. I do believe that the role of school leadership faculty is to figure out how to deal with the complexity of change, live on the edge of chaos, not run from it. Where I ended up with is the question, how the process we went through might be made less traumatic and smoother. I don't have the answers. We went through deep structural changes which caused all of us to rethink our own work, what was renegotiable and what was not. I also believe that the state's competencies asked us to do things we don't have the knowledge or skills to do well. For example, teaching reading to speakers of other languages or designing ESC programs. The standards called for instructional practices requiring in-depth knowledge that most professors don't have. It's a huge job to reform, and it will take more than well-intentioned actions to make change. I hope we can continue to reckon with and think about them beyond this presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings our session to an end. Yet, there are still voices in the air. Speak up now, or be silent.
Ira, I think you're wearing rose-colored glasses. You and the faculty have summed up the process and products as more positive than I recall them being. We are good little soldiers in the state's army. That's how I feel. We still have not gotten to the good stuff, like talking about social justice or diversity or those other strands. We have not yet created concrete strategies, course binders with skills listed and links to the education code, or a test prep course to minimize the impact of teaching 91 skills in our 5-week-long classes. In fact, we have not yet talked about whether our 3-credit course structure has outlived its usefulness in such a prescriptive curriculum environment. Master's level students are not concerned about us winning their hearts, maybe their minds. Yes, insofar as it helps them pass the state examination. I know my heart has not been won. Counterinsurgency. What counterinsurgency? Legacy? Ugh.
As I listen to this narrative, I get the sense that we will each have our own unique and idiosyncratic ways to interpret events through our own well-crafted philosophical perspective. For me, the battle of who controls schools is part of the battle for who controls knowledge within the nation, state, and across borders, who has access and who does not, and who is given power over others to shape the discourse of school reform.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast, and we want to thank Professor Edie Rusch, editor of the Journal of Research on Leadership in Education, and the leadership of UCEA for bringing this presentation to you today. For myself and the Florida Atlantic University Educational Leadership Faculty, thank you all for listening.